From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States is a deeply religious country. A poll in 2016 by the Public Religion Research Institute found that nearly 70% of Americans identify as Christian, and about 45% say they attend church regularly. Of the rest, of course, there are myriad other religions, including Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, etc. There are constitutional protections for religious beliefs. And in fact, the idea of religious liberty has been deeply politicized by Donald Trump's government and the American evangelical right wing. But what about the non-believers among us? Why, in a nation that also separates church from state, is there such an outsized representation of religion and protections of religious liberties? A new history book attempts to explore this question. Its co-author R. Lawrence Moore now joins me. He's a professor emeritus of History and American Studies at Cornell University, and his co-author is Isaac Kramnick. The name of the book is Godless Citizens in a Godly Republic, Atheists in American Public Life. Welcome to the program, Larry.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, of course, the history of the United States is very, very critical to this question of why there are so many protections for Christians and Christianity and religion and religious people in general, and so few for atheists, right? This was basically a country founded by people who were escaping religious persecution. Is that, in a nutshell, why we have such a deeply religious country today that protects religious views so much, or is it a lot more complicated than that?
Well, you know it's more complicated than that.
But that's why you wrote a book about it.
Yeah, and it's of course not just history. I mean, I want to say one thing right out that, you know, I taught American religious history for 40 years and wrote about it. And there is nothing in this book that is meant to be hostile to religion. It is simply a sort of bringing up to date the concept of non-belief, atheism, agnosticism, non-theism, whatever you want to call it, and putting it on an equal plane with everything else. Now, historically, it wasn't in the beginning for a lot of reasons, not only federal law, but mainly state law. And it goes back to colonia, it goes back to England, when people who did not believe in God were defined as non-trustworthy. You couldn't swear an oath to God. You couldn't be, you know, expected to tell the truth.
And I'm assuming blasphemy was a crime.
And blasphemy was a crime in England and in most of the American states. Now, that has changed to a considerable extent, but, you know, polls are difficult to sort of call and figure out numbers, but it is certainly true, and it's unambiguously true, that if you singled out a group that most Americans find untrustworthy when it comes to holding public office, people they said they would never vote for, they would vote for women, they would vote for homosexuals, they would vote for Muslims, they would vote for Mormons, other groups that have had some trouble, you know, with mainstream Protestant America. You know, agnostics, you know, and atheists far outweigh that prejudice. And it's odd, you know, because, you know, for one thing, the number of non-believers has grown tremendously in the past 20 years. So their numbers probably equal the number of so-called evangelicals, what you term the right-wing and evangelical movement. So they're not insignificant. And they also are heavily overrepresented in the professions and in academia. And, you know, with people who are truly creative among artists and writers and so on, their numbers are even more. So it's a little bit odd that this country, and which is an advanced industrial society and prides itself on being well-educated, cannot come to grips with the fact that there's nothing dangerous about non-belief. It's simply what many people take to be their conviction, as seriously as any person takes religion, or theistic religion, to be serious. And the courts are beginning to recognize that. what isn't particularly being recognized is a lot of the cultural symbolism, our motto, "In God We Trust." It used to be Pluribus Unum. That's a great slogan, out of many one. "In God We Trust," it speaks to many people, but it doesn't speak to a significant minority. So it's divisive. It's not a great national motto. I'm sorry.
Right. "In God We Trust." And also, of course, when people are taking oaths of office, just the fact that they're to take an oath, and usually it's something that's done on a religious book. All of those things are encroachments of religion into the state, against this idea that we have a separation of church and state. And of course, there is a protection of religious liberty in the Constitution. Much has been made of that, including the right of a baker to not bake a cake for a gay couple. But what about the fact that we do have a right to not believe, and our non-belief should not be held against us? You said there's a growing number of atheists in American society. Are they sort of disproportionately underrepresented in elected office because religion seems to be some sort of, a requirement for holding office?
You know, many state constitutions, well, not many, but eight still, even though this has been struck down by the Supreme Court, have a provision in their constitutions that holders of any public office, even a justice of the peace, must believe in God.
Really?
Yeah, really. And
wow.
Those provisions are sort of null and void, but the states in question haven't removed them from the Constitution because it's sort of a political question. They've been asked to do that, but they haven't done it. Now, so there is, an atheist can run for public office anywhere. Whether an atheist wants to run for public office saying, "Hey, I don't believe in God," that's another question, because any political advisor would tell somebody, if you want to run for public office, make some pretense of going to church, are acting like you believe in God, and then it doesn't even matter that you're a moral rascal. Like, well, we won't mention. Yeah, well, you know who I'm talking about.
And he who shall not be named.
Yes, he who shall not be named, who has been endorsed by evangelical leaders and so on. It just boggles the mind. But in any case, someone who says straight out, "I don't believe in God," you won't find many of those people in the American Congress. I think last time we looked, there were two. But in fact, there are many more. It's just they don't want to go on record as saying that. And, that's part of our problem. What kind of a society we have when people aren't afraid, or somehow, if they're running for public office, that they have to duck what they really believe? There's nothing wrong with being a non-believer. I mean, that's the point of we're not bad people. We're not, the child molesters are somewhere else. It's not us.
And indeed, child molesters are very much affiliated with the Catholic Church these days, more so than any other institution.
Yeah, no, but it's true. I mean, there's nothing about non-belief that is allied with unethical behavior or criminal behavior or sexually deviant behavior. It's just a form of belief, and most of the non-believers I know are deeply, deeply ethical, moral people who think a whole lot about the difference between right and wrong and how to make the world a better place.
So, Larry, how does the U.S. compare to other democracies, other industrialized nations, even just in the West? European countries have very religious origins, have a deep cultural history rooted in religion. But in contemporary terms, how does the U.S. compare to European countries, say?
Well, one thing about Europe, of course, is their history is rooted in real religious warfare. I mean, you have to go back several centuries, even before. So they spent a lot of time resolving that. And when they got beyond that, they still had a lot of laws that favored Catholicism and Christianity. And, a lot of Europeans in the 19th century had to fight against established churches, powerful established churches. Which at least you can say in the United States, we didn't. Not in the same way, anyway. So there was a lot of anti-clericism that developed in Europe as a result. And by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, a lot of people are declared agnostics, non-believers. And that's the way it's been ever since. And so I like to say that in some ways we're catching up with France, Italy, Spain, Ireland, even England, where, you know, religion as a matter of deep-seated conviction just hasn't been very important to the majority of the populations there.
And indeed,
I suspect that's where we're headed.
And of course, one of the things that sets the U.S. apart is this bizarre role that evangelical Christians, especially in recent decades, have played in American politics, right? There was a concerted effort for evangelicals to become politically active, and, you know, church leaders guiding their congregations on how to vote, etc. America is home to this phenomenon called mega churches that also have become often tools, political tools in getting these massive congregations to, you know, vote on certain hot button issues like abortion or LGBT rights. Is that also something that makes the U.S. relatively unique?
Yes, it is. And what's interesting about these so-called mega churches, which are often, though not always, very politically active in a partisan way. I mean, there's no secret that their politics are deeply, deeply conservative, both on economic and social and cultural issues. So it's the Republican Party that has tried to, shall I say, milk that kind of, or tap into that kind of energy. And it's been effective in certain elections. And, you know, the politicians haven't given up on it. But what's interesting to me is if you sort of look at what happened, particularly to American Protestantism. The story of Catholicism is a little different, but these megachurches really destroyed the traditional structures of American Protestant churches so that the well-known American Protestant congregations, with the exception of Southern Baptists, have much, much diminished roles in American life. They're tiny percentages of the population. And so that weakened sort of social action, not political action, social action of traditional Protestant churches. But the obvious political endorsement by evangelical leaders, which really dates back in a serious way to Ronald Reagan and Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority and so on, you know, that's also about the same time when you find young people in particular being turned off by religion. You know, there is a correlation between the rise of these politically active evangelical churches, which seem to be sometimes about anything except religion, and the number of people who are increasingly leaving churches and saying, you know, that's not for me. You know, if I want to be a politician, I'll join a political party and be politically active. I don't have to join some mega church. So it's kind of shooting, these churches are in some ways shooting themselves in the foot, even though they still think, you know, they've still, you know, said, all of them, double down on these elections that are coming up, the midterm elections. They're putting everything on Trump and Donald Trump-supported candidates.
Now, give us a sense of some of the battles that took place in the early American history that ended up resulting in the sort of religious supremacy that we have today. We seem to be a conflicted nation on the one hand, wanting a separation of church and state and being proud of that to some extent, and on the other hand, really emphasizing religion and a requirement of religion. So what were some of the battles that took place?
Well, the first battle, of course, was the American Constitution, because getting the so-called religious clauses the no religious test clause in the body of the American Constitution and the First Amendment passed, which was meant to put all religious groups, and, you know, not necessarily excluding non-believers, by the way, on an equal footing. That was different than what existed in Europe at the time. So what turned out, of course, is that many of the founders who wrote the Constitution were deists. They weren't Christians. They believed in God, but they believed in a God who sort of had gone away and left the world to run itself. and put their faith really in reason. Then in the beginning of the 19th century, there's all kinds of ironies that once churches were told you have to go out and find your own way in the world, the government is not going to give you money to build your churches or to pay the salaries of your ministers, then these churches started competing. And it was very successful business, so that, you know, Methodist and Baptist and Presbyterians, there is in the first part of the 19th century, really the first enormous churching of America. And for many immigrants coming into the country, churching was a way of finding one's identity, one's roots. It was a way of saying who you were in America, so that it's really interesting. And there's nothing in Europe, because Europe still had predominantly one religion. In many countries, that was Catholicism. In other countries, it was whatever the dominant Protestant church was, the Church of England, for example, in England. But in America, there was just wide open competition. And the wide open competition resulted in a lot of religious energy. It's fascinating, by the way. This is what sort of intrigues me about American history. And 19th century is really very different. So you have people, and not everybody, but people invested in religion. So if you're left out of that, if you are an atheist or agnostic, you can fall afoul of blasphemy laws in the early part of the 19th century for saying something. You know, one of our favorite characters is Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine, who wrote documents that did as much as anybody to fuel the American Revolution. And he was very popular. You know, his books, you know, people still claim that some of Paine's writings sold as well as anything ever published in the United States. But then he also, after he spent some time in France, published The Age of Reason, which ridiculed biblical religion, ridiculed the Bible, ridiculed people who believed in the Bible. It's very, you know, depending on your point of view, it's pretty funny reading. But he was reviled for that. He became a dirty, filthy atheist. And, you know, it's hard to find, but, you know, something like a dozen people attended his funeral, and people forgot about him for a long time. Another favorite example by the meat that has to do with feminism is Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Because along with Susan B. Anthony, she, of course, you know, sort of the pinnacle of the early fight for women's rights, including the right to vote. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton, very early in her life, decided she didn't believe in God, she didn't believe in Christianity, and in fact went farther and decided that Christianity was really the real problem of women, what was holding them down. And she said this, she said it publicly and loudly, and it wasn't a popular point of view in the women's movement. And
of course, in retrospect, a lot of this seems surprising to us, but many people used the Bible and continue to use a very old religious text to curtail the rights of people. So religious liberty becomes a bludgeon against human rights and full rights of citizenship, which of course provokes a backlash.
Used as Martin Luther King Jr. used it to support civil rights for people.
Exactly. So it can certainly be used in many different ways. Yeah.
But when religion is used as a tool to discriminate, that's when I just don't get it, because the whole notion of religious liberty was to end discrimination against groups so that everybody was on an equal plane. And if you wanted to be a Unitarian, or for that matter, a non-believer in theory, or a Jew or a Catholic or Islam, whatever you wanted to believe, you were on an equal basis before the law. That wasn't true in Europe. It frankly wasn't quite true in many of the United States. So when you find religion, you mentioned the Colorado baking case, and we'll see more of this, when you find religion being asserted as a right to discriminate, to refuse service to somebody, this just boggles the mind. This is exactly what religious liberty was not supposed to do.
So picking up on what you said earlier about this competition in the US and the early US for the various religions, that because the US didn't have the same history as Europe, we have found that the church has become this space of community, right? People look for community in this country where identity, the notion of cultural identity, is a fraught one. Aside from Native Americans, we are a nation of immigrants. Do you find that the search for community through religion has played a role in religious supremacy in the U.S., which of course leaves non-believers and atheists outside?
It certainly played a role in becoming American, if you like, for many immigrant groups to create their own church, to have their own church, sometimes with their own language being spoken in that church, was very, very important. And it was a sense of community. And, the best example of this, frankly, is in the African American community, where Black churches were a way of asserting a sense of right and pride.
And let me correct myself. Earlier, I said we are a nation of immigrants except for Native Americans and, of course, African Americans who have ancestors who were enslaved. So go ahead.
Yeah, it is. I quite like the kind of community that can be found in many kinds of churches. There's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't necessarily tend to elevate your group over other groups. So it can. But it's not necessarily, community is a hard thing to find in a large country, and you're an immigrant and you've just gotten here and everything seems hostile or against you. And so you find a community where you can get it, and the church often supplied that. And, it's hard to quarrel with that. I think what has happened in today's megachurches is exactly the loss of community. That those churches don't find community. And one of the things that Isaac and I say in our book, one of the problems that non-believers have, even though they're very numerous and why many of them are sort of reluctant to admit what they believe, is they haven't found the same kind of community. There are various organizations now that are attempting to join non-believers into societies and organizations, and they've been remarkably successful, but there's still a long way to go. One of the things we talk about in our book is Felix Adler, who was German Jewish, very prominent families, but he was supposed to become the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in New York, but he just couldn't do it. He said, "I no longer believe any of that. Well, I don't believe that anymore." So he went off and founded the Ethical Culture Society, which still exists in New York, which was a society of free thinkers who had no, strong connection to any religious tradition, and certainly not to biblical religion. But they were trying to form a community where they could come together, yes, on Sundays, and meet together and talk together and feel bonded together. And that was very admirable. And it worked up to a point, and then it stopped working. But, community is a tough thing to find in the United States. It's a tough thing to find. And we don't have the kind of national rituals and rites and coming together in public space that you find in smaller countries, in Europe and everywhere else in the world.
Right. Well, you were saying earlier, I want to just end on this question, that the sort of numbers of people who identify as atheist or agnostic, et cetera, is rising. Why do you think that is? What is it that, this may be more of a sort of, a psychological question or existential question, but why do you think there are growing numbers of people who are moving away from religion in the United States?
Well, I think, there are all kinds of answers you could give to that. The simplest one of the ones that secularists like to give is that, look, we're a scientific technological age, and believing about some man in the sky is really doing things that affect our daily life, and we can pray to that God to make things all well with us. You just can't believe that anymore. Well, in fact, many people do believe that. And So I don't think that it's just the rise of science and rationalism and technology that has secularized the world. It's simply that religion isn't providing the kinds of answers that people are looking for. They certainly aren't going to find it very many people in those evangelical churches you mentioned. They're just not.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Larry, and good luck with the book.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. My guest has been R. Lawrence Moore, a professor emeritus of history and American studies at Cornell University. We've been discussing the book he co-authored with Isaac Kramnik called Godless Citizens in a Godly Republic, Atheists in American Public Life. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.